Last week we finished Esther 3. Mordecai has been sitting at the king's gate, and lots of reasons why that would be. So he is sort of a de facto member of the king's staff, if you will. And one of the things that he does as part of that is he gets word of a coup attempt that's going to happen. And he informs the king, and the coup attempt gets broken up, and the two plotters, Bigtan and Teresh, are executed. Up until that point, the king had had a very open administration. The big feast in chapter one, he's got all of the officials of the empire, all of his local officials. He invites the whole town of Susa in. After that, he apparently got spooked. So what he did is he put Haman in charge. This is the first time anybody's heard of Haman. He wasn't at the big party. He's not one of the king's regulars. We know he's an Agagite, but we don't know where he came from in the empire. And what the king did is decided that having all those people with access to him was not safe. So he closed himself off and made Haman the gatekeeper. Now, one of the things we're going to find out is that Haman really wants to be king. And we're going to see some stuff going on here that anybody with eyes in his head would be able to see that this guy wants to be king. I was reading a thing from Aleph Beta last night. We were talking about why doesn't Mordecai bow to Haman? And there's some interesting stuff here. The question is, why is Mordecai not bowing down? The stated reason is because I'm a Jew. Well, so what? Jews don't particularly have any problem with bowing before people. When the 11 brothers of Joseph stand before him, they bow. Nobody has any problem with bowing, so what's the problem here? And where Aleph Beta goes with that is Mordecai and Joseph are both sons of Rachel. All the other brothers are somebody else's sons with Jacob, but those two are full brothers. And so what he does is he looks back at the time Joseph is a slave in Egypt and rises to viceroy, and he compares it with what's going on with Mordecai, with the idea that these two guys are full brothers. And where he goes, which is, I think, really fascinating, is in Genesis 39, where Joseph has risen to the head of Potiphar's household. Potiphar's wife takes a shine to him and tries to get him to sleep with her. And that is in 39, starting in verse 6.5. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and after a time his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her or lie beside her to be with her. And we know the rest of the story, that she frames him for rape and so forth. This is actually pretty much the same words as what's going on with Haman. Esther 3:3. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when he spoke to him day after day, he would not listen to them. Notice the words are exactly the same. Joseph would not listen to her. He will not listen to them as they speak to him day by day. So that's where Foreman gets his hook. Now, where he goes from that, I think, is really very, very good. Potiphar's wife winds up framing him, and he gets thrown in jail, and he's in jail for quite a few years until he finally gets bailed out by Pharaoh many years later. He knows Potiphar's wife's character. He knows that if he sleeps with her, then it'll all be okay. but he is loyal to Potiphar. So the thing that got him raised to the position where he is his loyalty and his competence. So Potiphar has been able to trust him with anything. So he says, that's a line I won't cross. And he is willing to accept whatever consequences attend that decision. So when the wife comes in and screams that he tried to rape me, he doesn't say in front of everybody, no, I didn't. He simply gets thrown to jail. The same thing appears to be going on with Mordecai and Ahasuerus. Mordecai is loyal to Ahasuerus. And the decree, back in chapter 3 of Esther, verse 2, and all the king's servants who were in the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. And apparently that in Hebrew is ambiguous. Who's him? What Foreman says, with some credibility, obviously, since he reads Hebrew and I don't, is the king told Haman, but didn't tell anybody else. So this looks like Haman is grabbing to himself the trappings of royalty. What we'll see tonight when the king is up in the middle of the night and can't sleep and has the chronicles brought to him, he reads about Mordecai's delivering him and Haman's in the court. He says, hey, Haman, come here. How should we honor a guy that has served the king so well? Haman thinks, who could that be but me? And he then proceeds to describe dressing up in the king's clothes and being paraded around on the king's horse. He wants to be king. What's going to happen the next thing is when Esther invites him into her party, she invites just him and the king. Well, wait a minute. Is he also after my wife? Foreman's point here is that the loyalty of the sons of Rachel will operate even to their own detriment. So Joseph is loyal to his own detriment. Mordecai is also loyal to his own detriment. And quite frankly, I think Mordecai was just thinking, I'm going to get kicked around a little bit. He wasn't expecting that we're going to wipe out all the Jews. That was a surprise to him. But I thought that was a really interesting perspective on why Mordecai wouldn't bow down to Haman. It's because he sees what this guy is trying to do. He has already proved himself loyal to Ahasuerus by foiling the plot against his life. So he's loyal to the king, and this guy in between has obviously way overstepping his bounds. So he isn't going to cooperate with that. I thought that was a good insight. There's all sorts of insights. One of them was Haman was wearing an idol around his neck, and Mordecai looked at him. I'm not going to bow down to that because you got an idol on you. There's no scriptural support for that. I think Rabbi Foreman's is probably more credible. So anyway, there we are. We have this edict, and so now what we're going to do in chapter 4 is get Esther into the picture. So we're now at chapter 4. Mordecai learned all that had been done. Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. So what Mordecai is doing is he is launching a public protest. And he has got all the rest of the Jews launching public protests. And he is not allowed in that state to get into the inner court because you got to be dressed right to get in front of the king. So he's held up outside there and he is protesting this decree in a very loud and public way. You can think of half a dozen organizations that we know about that are engaged in performative protesting, and so that's what he's doing. Verse 4, When Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. And I'm not sure what's going on there. Mordecai is not a poor man. He is not in rags and ashes because he can't afford him. He is there because he's protesting. So I'm not sure why she's sending him clothes, but she did. The answer was, well, maybe so he can come in and tell her what's going on. No, because the fact that they are related is a secret. And the story hinges on the fact that Haman doesn't know that the queen is related to Mordecai. So getting him in so he can talk to her cousin, that's not what's going on here. Verse 5. Then Esther called for Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. Hatak went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him, and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of her people. So at this point, Esther has no idea what's going on. The rumor mill has just said, this crazy guy is out in front in sackcloth and ashes. They don't even know that they're related. I'm sure it's just palace gossip. There's this crazy guy out in the gate, and he's wailing and mourning and all that kind of stuff. Named Mordecai, you know, he's a Jew and all that kind of stuff. So the fact that she's related to him isn't really known. She's just picking up palace gossip. So the edict and everything comes back to her, and Mordecai sends a request that she go talk to the king and see if we can do something about this. Verse 9, and Hatak went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. When Esther spoke to Hatak and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's province know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come to the king these 30 days. So her answer is no. You asked me to go and intervene with the king? No. And no because this, and no because of that, and no because of the other reason, but basically it is no. Now, this business of if you go into the king and the king doesn't recognize you, you're put to death, is again an artifact of the coup attempt. And so he has strictly limited access to himself. As a practical matter, for Esther to go in under such circumstances is virtually zero risk, because he's already gotten rid of one queen. And he really doesn't want to go through that again for two reasons. One is, of course, he gets rid of a wife that he likes. And two, if he keeps killing off queens, pretty soon it's going to get around that this guy's kind of a jerk. And remember, that was the way he solved his first problem with Vashti. When Vashti refused to come in and see him, and he has been jacked up in front of his entire government, the way he gets out of it is to turn it into an affair of state. This is not an uppity wife who doesn't listen to her husband. This is the queen who has disrespected the king. What should we do about that? And put out the edict and all that kind of stuff. But if he keeps going through queens, pretty soon it's going to be, what's wrong with this guy? So realistically speaking, she is not at risk. However, having said that, she also doesn't want to take advantage of her position to put her husband in a place where he has got to make a decision that he really doesn't want to make. In other words, yeah, if you come into my throne room, yeah, I'm not going to have you killed, but boy, I wish you hadn't done that. That kind of thing. So realistically, there's not much risk, but I can see why she wouldn't want to do it. So verse 12. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Now, a couple of things about it. It is not known that Esther is a Jew. So she is not in any danger from Haman's edict. What Mordecai is saying is, if you don't do it, something supernatural will arise to get it done. If you don't deliver the Jews like I'm asking you to, God will figure out a way to do it himself. And oh, by the way, in that supernatural process, you're going to be destroyed because you didn't step up and do what was right. That's the message, if you will. 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Very famous. Every young Jewish girl memorizes that speech. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. First off, obviously, a fast in preparation for doing something like this is perfectly biblical. But it has a practical aspect. When Esther finally does come before the king after 3 days with no food and no water, she's going to look like she's been dragged through a knothole. So when she comes in, she's not going to be this beautiful, buoyant, bubbling princess. She is going to look not very good. So one of the things that will do is will impress upon the king, "Whoa, something serious is going on here. Why do you look like that?" Chapter 5. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request?" "It shall be given to you even unto half of the kingdom." And again, that's a formulaic thing. Obviously, half of the kingdom is not on offer here. 4. And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." And the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." Now, pay attention from here on, because you'll see this happening a number of times. Haman, of course, has got megalomania and really wants to be king. He wants to dress up as the king, and he's going to be, "Ooh, Esther, the queen invited the king and I only," and so forth. One of the things that you'll notice if you're paying attention is the king jerks him around. "Oh, we got a dinner appointment. Go get him. Get him in here. And, you know, who's in the court? Come here, you." It's very much a, "Yeah, I know you're the viceroy, and I sort of know what you got in mind," and he sort of jerks him around periodically to keep him aware of who's who. And as we read the rest of it, you'll see it several places. At this point, if you were the king, you would start to wonder, what on earth is going on with this guy Haman? Why is he being invited to my wife's quarters for a private feast between the two of us? And I'm sure that word has gotten around that Haman has told everybody, "You got to bow in front of me," and all that kind of thing. So he may be a little dense, but at some point here he's going to get it. Verse 5, then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, so that we may do as Esther has asked." So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said. So the first one is back in verse 4. And Esther said, if it please the king, let king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king. That's not what the Hebrew says. What it says is for him. So who's him? You understand, again, the setup that's being done here. Now, pop up a level. This is commentary by Yoram Hazoni, who's written a book on Esther called The Dawn. Some of my insights are from that, and this one is. Esther is a very pretty young woman. She's very smart. She's a great wife. She is not the chief of staff of the king. So the king has relied on the advice of his chief of staff to set up the destruction of this people within his kingdom who are completely apart and don't follow the laws or anything like that. So the king is assuming that his chief of staff has got a good reason for what he says. Esther, if she goes and says, wait a minute, you can't kill all those people. What she's doing is going head to head with the king's chief of staff in the area of the chief of staff's expertise. She has no credibility there. She's a wife, she's a companion, she's a beautiful woman, all those kinds of things, but she doesn't have a track record as being the chief of staff or knowing anything about affairs of state. So for her to go head to head against Haman in the area where he is the expert, she risks being said, well, that's nice, dear. Well, you just go tend to your embroidery and so forth and let us run the kingdom, with a condescending smile. So she doesn't go head to head with Haman on this. What she's doing is she's setting Haman up for what's going to happen, which is to get the king to the point where he says, whoa, this guy's after my crown and now he's after my wife? I think we need to get rid of this guy. That's what she's engineering. Verse 9. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate, then he neither rose nor trembled before him. He was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet, all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. The idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. 50 cubits is 75 feet. The whole idea here is we string this insolent Jew up and we hang him way up where everybody in town can see him. The whole idea is that is how we are going to deal with attempted rebellion. You demonstrate against one of the king's edicts, you're going to wind up there with Mordecai. So the whole thing is designed to intimidate everybody. And I suspect that what he would say as he went in to request the removal of Mordecai is, you got this guy that is publicly demonstrating and protesting against one of your edicts. I'm going to suggest that we get that guy out of here before he causes more trouble. Of course, the king would say, yeah, go ahead, do it, because the king doesn't care. So that's Haman's plan. Now, neither Haman nor the king is suspicious. Haman's survival instinct, wait a minute, what is going on here with Esther inviting me and the king to this private little dinner party? Twice. Same thing with the king. What is going on here? Is there something going on between Haman and the queen? And so it becomes a big surprise, which is what it's intended to do. So on to chapter 6. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the Book of Memorable Deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuch who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Pause there for a minute, recap. What's going on there is everybody thinks that Ahasuerus is Xerxes I. So if you read the history of Xerxes I, his father got defeated at the Battle of Marathon and bounced. So Xerxes comes and he wins the battle at Thermopylae. However, he gets his fleet destroyed in a naval battle. And at that point, he withdraws personally from the campaign and leaves it to one of his underling generals. The underling general has some success, but finally also gets defeated in a naval battle. It is my speculation that this big feast that they had ahead of time was to plan for the invasion of Greece. That was the whole purpose, to get all the government together and get all the resources organized for the invasion of Greece. When that invasion fails and he comes back, it is entirely possible and even probable that some of his staff decide to assassinate him because he has failed. That's what happens to Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, who tries to take Jerusalem and is repulsed. And he goes back home and his two sons murder him, and one of them becomes king in his place. So this coup plot that Mordecai has uncovered and thwarted very well may have been because of the failure to conquer Greece. So, having said all that now, the king has got insomnia. So he has the chronicles brought in and have somebody read local history. And they read about Mordecai having saved his life. Verse 3, and the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing's been done for him. The king obviously does not know that it's Mordecai that is sitting in sackcloth and ashes and protesting outside of the gate. Because remember, the king has deliberately isolated himself from the rest of the court. And all of the information that he gets filtered through Haman. And of course, Haman is now about to come in and tell him we need to get rid of this guy. But up until then, he obviously has no idea what's going on. Probably doesn't even know there is a protest, much less that it's Mordecai. Verse 4, and the king said, who is in the court? Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is here, standing in the court. The king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought that the king has worn, and a horse that the king has ridden on, and whose head the royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, then lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before them, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Now, this is beyond stupid. The guy is already a megalomaniac. He clearly wants to be king, and to do something that transparent is not bright. What he's done is he's spring-loaded the king in the suspicious position. And so when something happens at the dinner that night, the king is just going to go absolutely berserk, which he does. So Haman, his hubris getting the best of him, it's going to kill him. The smart thing would be, so who might this be, O king? Let's put him in the royal chariot and drive him around town a little bit, or, you know, something. But he doesn't ask that question. Verse 10, then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." And you can just hear him grinding his teeth all the way down to the gums as he does that. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." This I find strange, because when he asked their advice before, they say, "Build a gallows." As far as I know, it is common knowledge among the king's court that Mordecai is a Jew. Because when he refused to bow down to Haman, and everybody asked him, "What are you doing? Why are you doing that? Why aren't you bowing?" He simply would say, "I'm a Jew." So this is well known to everybody. Certainly it would be well known, I'm sure, to Haman's household and its scuttlebutt around the court. So for them, on the one hand, to say, "Build a gallows and hang him," and on the next thing, "Oh, well, if this guy's a Jew, you're not going to make it." One of those things that I find weird. Verse 14. While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuch arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." And Queen Esther answered, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, and to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent. For our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king." So what she's saying is, if they had simply ordered us enslaved, I would have kept my mouth shut, because slaves are valuable to the king. So we've got to be slaves. Well, that's a useful thing, and I would never, never protest it, because it would cost the king revenue. A little bit of butter being spread there. Verse 5. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe, an enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. So he's not so much upset about her people being killed, because he signed the edict. What he is really ripped about is somebody has dared to threaten his queen. The fact that she also happens to be a Jew is not anything he knows. She is saying, somebody's trying to kill me and all my people, because the edict is against everybody of that people, and I'm one of them. And the king is more than just a little ripped, because he sees somebody attacking his household. And so Haman turns white as a sheet. And the king rose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. So they've been having a wonderful feast. He's got a snootful. He had a snootful before, and realizes that at this point he's probably not going to do anything rational. So he gets up and walks out of the room rather than make a drunken fool of himself. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. In other words, he could see just how grumpy the king was about all this. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. So Esther is sitting on a couch, and he is falling down at her feet on the couch, pleading for his life. Well, that position, it turns out, is ambiguous. Verse 8. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house?" Now, at this point, he's starting to get it. He's recognizing that Haman wants to be king. He recognizes, you know, blinding flash of the obvious, what was going on with Mordecai and all that kind of stuff. And now this guy is falling all over his wife. And, oh, by the way, we're the only two that were invited to supper. Was she going to tell me something? Was she going to make a little announcement that she and Haman were made for each other, we were soulmates, or, you know, something like that? When you're really angry, you can see things differently, and you can react jealously to something that is ambiguous, absolutely true. And then you said, well, he wasn't groping her. We don't know that, because what he may have done is fallen at her feet and was holding her feet and pleading, that kind of thing, or holding her hands and pleading with her. And so him coming back in, A, drunk, and B, angry, and seeing that, 8.5. As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face, which is to say they put a sack over his head. Think about CIA abductions where they grab you off the street and put a black bag over your head. 9. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance to the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high. Little bit of palace infighting there. Obviously, Haman has got very few friends in court. So when Harbona sees, things have very much changed, Haman is no longer in favor, he then sticks the knife in and twists it and lets the king know that Haman has prepared a gallows to kill the hero who delivered the king's life, which sort of indicates that at this point, Haman was lucky only to have been hanged. Could be a lot worse. Verse 10, and the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that had been prepared for Mordecai, and the wrath of the king abated.